and welcome to David's Book Talk. And today we have a very special guest. His name is Barry Livingston, and he was on the TV show My Three Sons. He played Ernie. And he's written a new book called The Importance of Being Ernie, From My Three Sons to Mad Men, A Hollywood Survivor Tells All. And he's here, and it's published by Citadel Press, and he's here to talk about it. Hello.
Yeah, hey, how's it going?
Yeah, a little delay there.
No, I'm here. I'm a little delayed. Yeah, I'm getting up there in age, but no, I'm with you now.
This book is really interesting. I mean, you've been through a lot, and yet nowhere in this book do you really, you don't complain a lot. You don't seem like a complainer.
I don't really. Well, you'll have to check, you know, confirm that with my wife. I'm sure she gets the brunt of it, but you know, I tend, even today, I'm still an actor, I still work, I'm still very focused on getting jobs, and I sometimes amaze myself. I'll wait a day, if I don't hear anything, you know, if it's a thing, you just kind of go into a funk. But then I get out of it pretty quick, and that's been my pattern over time. I think I want something very badly, I put everything I have into trying to get the job, and you don't get it, yeah, you know, there's a, I'll complain and, you know, be a little bit, you know, down for a day or two, but then I bounce back, and I guess that's the story of my life. I've been bouncing back for about 50 years now.
And that's the joy of reading this book, is to realize this is a guy who's worked and worked and worked, and nothing's been handed to you. You had to work for everything you got. I mean, nobody just came up and said, here, you're going to be an actor. Enjoy it.
Yeah, when you're a child actor, it's such a mixed bag because you're given such an incredible gift early on. You know, you're given the keys to the palace, and then they take them away. Of course, they just change the locks. You know, they just don't tell you that suddenly you're no longer a welcome customer, in the kingdom anymore. And that, you know, that knocks you down a peg or two. You know, your ego is pretty fragile, particularly when you're young.
And that's what's remarkable. You've been knocked down, but you've never been out.
I haven't, and God knows, I guess I have some. I'm wired that way, that I'm stubborn, and it hurts. Not that it hasn't hurt. Not that I haven't been discouraged. But I think at the end of the day, I usually go, what can I do today that's going to make me feel better? I'm going to show them. I don't know what the motivation is for it. You know, sometimes it is just being stubborn to go, I'm better than what I'm being given due for, and I'm going to prove it to you. Sometimes, you know, I know I've probably suffered from that to some degree, but it's a good thing to suffer from when you're particularly in show business, and it's a cruel, hard, cold business, and rejection is daily. You know, it's just a tough, tough business to survive in. So that said, yes, I am pretty resilient, I guess, over the years. I've learned that.
And I feel myself with a tear in my eye when you met your wife, who was Karen, who was later to become your wife. When I read that story, I thought, it was so moving to me because of, here's a guy who's worked and worked and worked, and you didn't really have time for a personal life. I mean, My Three Sons, it was one for, what, 12 years?
Yeah, My Three Sons was one of the second longest running sitcom in history, and then before that it was on the Ozzie and Harriet show for years as a recurring character. So, yeah, My Three Sons went off the air, and, I did work quite a bit, and then, you know, worked on Broadway, worked off Broadway, where I did a lot of episodics with Streets of San Francisco and Ironside and another series called Sons and Daughters. And then inexplicably, when I hit my late 20s, things went away. You know, that was the period. And fortunately for me, I did meet my wife not too long after, the good times changed. I can't say they vanished, but my career took a turn. Sometimes it takes you a while to even realize that. You just go, well, things are slow. And you go, yeah, things are really slow. And then you go, oh, man, you know, I the phone hasn't rang in a week. It's worse than slow. And then it's a year, you know, goes by. So, yes, my wife, we met in a very, very crazy kind of dramatic first meeting. I don't know. Would you like to hear that story? Do you think anyone is interested?
Of course people are interested. Well, they're going to find out when they read the book, but they're certainly interested.
Absolutely. I'll give you the short subject, the short story. We met in a bar, left, came across somebody who had slashed her wrist and was lying out in front of this bar. And we'd only known each other for about 10 minutes, but at that point we were going somewhere quieter. And it became a very kind of wild beginning to a beautiful 30-year marriage. But, you know, that was when I realized she could do CPR and she knew how to tie a tourniquet. And it was a crazy, crazy night. It's all detailed in the book. The Importance of Being Ernie is the name of the book. It was a wild, wild introduction to somebody. But, you know, that's how life is. Life is when you least expect it, something crazy, wonderful, you know, comes out of left field. That's what happens.
You've met a lot of famous people. I mean, it's remarkable. And that's another fun thing about the book. You never know who's going to come along next that you've met. I mean, Lucille Ball and Martin Landau. And, I mean, that's just the beginning. You've met Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward. I mean, the list goes on and on and on.
Yeah, I've had encounters with some pretty remarkable people in the show business. Elvis Presley, you know, we took a limo ride together once. Very kind of an odd, funny little ran into him on the lot at Paramount. He was shooting Fun in Acapulco. I was working on another movie. I just bumped into him when he was having his limousine delivered to him, a customized Cadillac limo. And he said, he just had a couple minutes. He said, I'm going to take it for a test spin around the lot. You want to hop in? And, you know, I'm a kid, you know, it's Elvis Presley. I was probably 10 years old or something, but I knew he was the biggest star in the world. And sure, you know, we took a slow like cruise around the lot. He flicked on the TV, which that completely blew me away. That you could have a portable TV in a car. It was like the Jetsons. Right. And we watched Popeye the Sailor. You know, we sat there and watched Popeye together for about 10 minutes.
That's something you never forget. Yeah, you never forget something like that.
It was pretty surreal. Yeah, it was very, very kind of a surreal, quiet, private moment. You know, and to have that kind of access to, you know, perhaps the biggest star of the last century. It is quite a memory. It's a great memory.
And when you first were on My Three Sons and the show got popular, what was life like for you? How did your life change? Explain to me what was going on. I mean, did you get any kind of a big head from having being on TV and being a famous kid star?
Well, I had the luxury, you know, of seeing a model. My brother Stan was Chip on My Three Sons. So, you know, it was an interesting way for me to come onto a series. It wasn't just like out of left field. I knew the people that were already involved, Fred McMurray and William Frawley and some of the stars of the show and the other brothers, and they knew me. So, you know, it was a very kind of smooth entry into what was then an enormously popular show. I mean, it was probably drawing 25, 35 million people a week.
That's a lot.
An era when they only had three networks, and that's, you know, was the only game in town.
Right.
So, it was probably the hardest thing was going back to public school, and your sense of who you are suddenly comes into conflict with what people think that they know you are, which is the character. But you're not really that character. It's somebody you're playing. And you know, the person is much more sensitive and complex, and particularly when you're a teenager and you're suddenly thrust into a public school situation, created some challenges. And, you know, sometimes the tapioca would fly, and I got very good at ducking, like, apple cores and things like that, just because kids are, you know, typically crazy and wild in high school. I met some great friends, and you know, but then there was some bullies that I had to handle, and you know, it was a real challenging time too.
I wonder. I mean, you probably never had any girls screaming at you like Luke Perry or any of those people on 90210. You know, like that's what they're like today. I mean, you look at Justin Bieber, who everywhere he goes, he's just mobbed. And I mean, did you ever have anything like that? Or close to that?
No, I mean, I had fans, but honestly, you know, I like to refer to myself as I was a prototype nerd, you know, the classic nerd of today who's brainy, kind of introverted, you know, sit in your room, build, you know, remote control automobiles and cars and build models and read books and, you know, comic books. That was pretty much my style, and so I wasn't hitting the party scene, if that's, you know, what you mean. That wasn't my style. I didn't have a posse at school. Were I not on television, I probably, you know, I nobody would have paid me a second glance because I was just, you know, that nerdy kid over in the corner with the book, you know, looking at some National Geographic magazine or Popular Mechanics. So, you know, that's who I was as a kid. And but, you know, then compounding that, I also was tremendously world famous. So that added a whole other element to survival, you know. The high school is a crazy jungle, and I you know, luckily survived it and tell all about it in the book, you know, what it was like to be famous in a public school with kids.
Right. Now, did you have any trouble memorizing your lines? I mean, was it? I mean, what's it like for a little? How old were you when you started on the show?
Well, I started on Sons when I was 10. The first thing I ever did was I was 4 years old when I'm 5. A movie with Paul Newman and Joe Elder called Rally Around the Flag Boys. But no, I just always seemed to have a pretty good memory. You know, it was fairly bright. You know, I got into the routine of, you know, reading something over 3 or 4 times with my dad. Eventually, you know, the night before you'd go to work, you'd read over the next day's work and prepare for it. And we would do that. And, I just took to it pretty easily. You know, I don't think I got a lot of coaching other than just, you know, help with the memorization. And hey, my dad wasn't all that crazy about me being in film or TV. It wasn't, you know, my parents, we wound up kind of getting into it by accident, and they went with it. But my mother, although she you know, put me into dance classes and singing once we kind of were doing more work as children. But even she kind of went, it's the most boring work in the world for a parent to sit with a child who's working on a film or TV, because you're just bored, mindless. You know, you sit there, and at least the kids got something to do. But you're just sitting there doing crossword puzzles day in and day out, or knitting, or whatever you can do. My parents kind of, my mom eventually got a guardian. She said, you know, I can't do this anymore. I'm going crazy. So she hired somebody to stay with me and my brother when we were working on Sons.
Right. I think people don't realize how tedious it can be. I mean, you're filming and they don't always need you on the set, and sometimes you have a lot of free time, and it always seems so exciting when you hear about it. You know, oh, I get to hang around famous people, and you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I get the feeling you really never hung around Fred McMurray off set, though.
Not much. He wasn't a real sociable guy in terms of inviting you over to his house for barbecues and, you know, vacationing. No, he was a great guy to work with. He was like the friendly, benevolent boss. You know, he was a sweet man, but in terms of having any kind of social interaction, that wasn't his style. He was a huge major star before he came to My Three Sons, having done Double Indemnity and the Caine Mutiny and, you know, all the Absent-Minded Professor movies for Disney. So he already had kind of his own social world of movie stars and kings and princes and people, famous people around the world. We were kind of the junior colleagues in his My Three Sons world, and that's the way it was. You know, we just accepted it. Nobody thought, you know, that we were slighted in any way. It's just he was, he was a big star, had his own social world, and we were people that he worked with.
I love you. I mean, you were on Mad Men, and I'm really jealous because that's one of my favorite shows of all time. There's something about that show that really gets to me. Every time I watch it, I laugh, and it's just so dramatic, and you never know what's coming next.
Yeah, it is. It was a great show, and I recall that era very well. My uncle, in fact, who lived in New York, was an ad guy, and I remember going into his company and seeing that whole kind of, you know, the whole arena of all these cubicles and people, you know, artwork. And in fact, when I first auditioned for Matt Weiner, who created Mad Men, and I kind of told him that whole story, my uncle really was, in addition to being an ad guy, was a member of the Communist Party. And he, you know, so it was a real hard thing for him that he was working in the belly of the capitalist beast, you know, concocting all kinds of slogans and ad campaigns to sell consumerism, which he found very, very disgusting. But, you know, at the same time, he had this whole other side of himself where he was a socialist, and he said, you know, what he would do every day, he was so disgusted with the whole world. He had to have a paycheck, so that's where he wound up. But he said he'd take about a 2 or 3 hour lunch. He'd clear his desk, close the blinds in his office, get up at his desk and sleep there for about 3 hours a day. So I told that to Matt Weiner. He thought, oh, that's funny, you know. And I don't know if that helped get me the part or not, but anyway, it fit with his design of Mad Men anyway.
How has it changed since you did My Three Sons and then doing Mad Men? There's a huge change in the way TV is today than it was years ago when you were doing My Three Sons. It seems like is it much harder to get parts today than it was then? And is the atmosphere totally different?
No, it's just as hard, really, you know, and it's as hard to get a small part as it is to get a big part, strangely enough. The process is the same. You get a call from an agent. They tell you to show up at a place at a certain time. You nowadays, fortunately, through the internet, get your materials, the scene you might read at your, for the casting, you know, people or producer at the audition. You get that the night before. You go in, you read, you know. Sometimes they'll take you for a call back to meet with other people in the company. Occasionally they just book you, you know. But that process is unchanged. It's been that way, you know, probably since the beginning of the way films and television have been put together. The content is obviously different. You know, that's where it's the biggest change in what we do today as actors is, you know, what you could talk about, what you could show are so radically different than what My Three Sons. I mean, they had a huge controversy on My Three Sons when Don Grady, who was the oldest son on My Three Sons, got married. And the censors and the people who were producing My Three Sons had their bedroom with them with twin beds. And, you know, the show was taking place in the 60s, and Don went, wait a minute, come on. You know, I mean, we're married now. You know, people, you know, can't we have a king-size bed, one bed in the room? And that was a big, you know, hurdle for the censors to get over, that, you know, the concept that they're married, they might be having sex, it just is, like, beyond them in terms of, you know, how, and eventually they caved, and they allowed them to have one bed in their bedroom. But, you know, that was a huge, huge step. Whereas today, you know, everything hangs out. You know, it's a completely different free for all in terms of what's shown and what isn't.
Yeah, it definitely is. I mean, and shows get canceled a lot faster today than they did then. I mean, it seems like as you said, you only had three major networks back then. Now you've got how many hundred networks now? It's just amazing.
Yeah, it's everything. So if they get, you know, if they get 6 million people to watch a show on cable, that's an enormous hit. You know, a show like Two and a Half Men, which is maybe the top rated sitcom today, probably gets 14, 15 million viewers,
right,
which is half of what, you know, Sons and Beverly Hillbillies and shows of that era from the 60s, Gunsmoke, you know, they would just get these 30, 40 million shares every week, which was, you know, it was huge, you know. But times change, you know, and it's a whole brand new universe and probably soon to change again. I mean, the internet, I think, is going to be change the landscape of how format and contents are being distributed.
That's kind of irks me sometimes. I'm watching a show and I find out there's more of it online. If I go online, I can watch a different part of it. You know, there's something, and I think, oh, you know what? I already have enough. I don't need anything more. You know, of the show. You know, I know where to find it. I don't want to have to go on the internet and look for more. You know,
right, or a new ending, you know, an alternate ending. You go, well, wait a minute, that means, you know, you've constructed a whole drama or comedy, and this one ends differently? You know, it's kind of interesting, but it seems odd, too, that, you know, you're watching a show that has a different ending, but, yeah, that's the way they do it these days.
Now, how did the book come about? Did they approach you, or did you, how did this happen that you wrote this book?
Well, you know, I just decided, people have told me over the years, you've got great stories, you know, and I'll tell people the story about riding in the limo with Elvis and working with Jerry Lewis on The Errand Boy and Jackie Gleason and, you know, people of that, Fred McMurray, you know, Jack Benny, people that I met over the years, great stories, and I, you know, people would say, you got to write those down. So, you know, eventually I came to a point where I went, I really should write those down. And I thought, you know, my career has had a real nice upswing, you know, in the last probably 10 years. And I'm working in films like The Social Network and just finished a film called Argo with Ben Affleck and You Don't Mess with the Zohan with Adam Sandler and Mad Men. So I went, you know, I see the arc of my life now where maybe 10 years, 15 years ago I didn't quite grasp, you know, the beginning, the middle, and it's a nice upward motion where I'm in now, and hopefully it continues that way. I thought, you know, it just seemed right. It just seemed like there's a completeness to the story. I may be entering chapter two of my life, but I felt like this first part felt complete, and so, you know, that all kind of came together, and I thought, I'm going to do this. You know, I'm going to sit down and put it on paper.
Now, this picture of you in Hostel 3, this is a classic picture. I mean, it's just like, what is up with him in this? You look like you're ready to kill somebody.
Well, that's exactly what my plan is. Yeah, the hostile series of films are, you know, they're not for everyone. My kids, you know, they thought that was the greatest career move I've ever made, that I'm going to be in Hostel 3 and playing one of the crazy killers in Hostel 3. They thought that was fantastic.
Is it at all disturbing to play a killer and to do all those scenes? I mean, I assume you filmed some of it, or are you going to film it in December?
It's already done. It's coming out, I think, probably at the end of this year, 2011. I think it's not so disturbing to do it. I find them very disturbing to watch. But the actual process is, you know, it's kind of funny and macabre and strange, and yeah, it can be a little bit disturbing even when you're doing it. But still, it's a movie, and you understand you're piecing together a whole kind of puzzle of scenes that turns into a movie. And then the end result is something that can be quite dramatic and disturbing. They're not my favorite films, but I had to look at it through, you know, my hands over my eyes and peeking through at it, you know, the Hostel 1 or 2. But again, I'm an actor. I'm a journeyman actor. I don't have the luxury, frankly, of picking and choosing every part that comes to me. I'm not a star, so it seemed like something interesting. I'd never played a character like that before, and I thought, yeah, I'm going to go for it. You know, my kids were crazy about the thing, and I thought,
right,
okay, you know, time to you know, maybe make a whole new group of fans that like that kind of stuff. So, yeah.
And you hear a lot that actors will do roles for their children, you know, whether it's a Disney movie or a voice in some film that mm-hmm. they'll do. Have you ever done voiceover stuff?
You know, I did some early, Alvin and the Chipmunks when it was a TV series. I knew Ross and Janice Bagdasarian, who, and at that time, I think they just had revived the franchise. Ross Bagdasarian's dad, I think it was Bagdasarian. I can't remember what his first name was. Maybe it was Ross Sr. Yeah. But anyway, you know, he revived there. He owned the franchise, revived it. Now it's feature films that earn $300 million around the world. So I did a little bit of voiceover work for them, you know, but not a lot, not as much as I'd like to, actually.
What would you be doing if you weren't an actor, do you think? I mean, where would you be?
I would probably, I like to write music. I play, in fact, I'm going to do a little rehearsal here in a little bit with my kids, and we have my wife and I have a band, and I probably would have pursued that a little more seriously. I'd like to continue on writing. I found it to be very enjoyable. The feedback that I'm getting from strangers and friends alike is, hey, you know, you have a way with words. It's a very pleasurable, fun read, and you have, you know, you recount these episodes and tales of famous people that you've encountered in an amusing, self-depreciating way. So I would like to pursue that, but, you know, we'll have to see what the future holds.
Now, your uncle, Sylvan, is he no longer with us?
No, he's gone. Yeah, he passed away about 20 years ago.
I love the picture of you with him. And
yeah,
but did he get you to guzzle any whiskey too, or was it just him?
No, I think he got me to guzzle some whiskey too. He was a serious drinker, and once I reached the appropriate age, yes, I'm sure we had a few toasts.
Right, is there anything you regret in your life?
You know, there are people, opportunities maybe that I might have had to travel to, you know, there's obviously has to be regrets. People, you know, life's too varied and complicated to say I've done everything I ever wanted to do. I would have liked to maybe have pursued school a little more than I did. I did take some, you know, college courses in terms of writing. I would have liked to have been more rounded person just in terms of my education. But, you know, every time I enrolled in a university or college, I, honest to God, I'd be real dead serious, I'm going to do this. And then I would get this really great offer to go off and do, you know, a play on Broadway or something. And I'd go, wow, you know, I've never had that before. I guess I should do it. So, yeah, it was a real, you know, it was hard to not follow through on more of an academic life, but I try to make up for that as much as I can, and just, you know, my own reading.
Now, did you have a diary while you were filming My Three Sons and Ozzie and Harriet and all the things you were doing? Do you have some kind of a diary?
Not really, no. I have a pretty good memory, you know, the stories that I recount.
You recount them quite in detail. I mean, there's a lot of detail in these. That's a lot to remember.
I do remember it very well. And, I mean, I guess I'm blessed at this point with still retaining a lot of the detail. You know, and that's the part that I found as a writer. I know it's interesting. You know, I found that fun to kind of delve into and to put that on paper and see how it comes out. And those things just stayed with me all these years. And maybe that over time you do tell a lot of stories. You do kind of recount the same story over and over to people because people usually want to know similar things about Ozzie Nelson or how was it to work with Ricky Nelson. Those things stuck with me, and, you know, fortunately I was able to put them down on paper, and it all made sense.
Yeah, I think if I ever was in the same town as you, I'd love to hear some of your stories. I mean, they're in this book, but I'm sure that you could go into better detail some of them. Because,
yeah.
You don't have time to tell every story in the book, but, I mean,
that's true. Well, I mean, I guess I'm saving a little bit for volume two. Maybe I can kind of get down, and once the book has finally got it's just come out, so I'll eventually sit down at my computer and maybe come up with a second volume of stories.
Would you ever write a novel?
You know, I'd like to do that. I'm not sure I'm capable of it. I know.
Why not? I mean, you have a lot of drive. I mean, just reading this book, I can tell that you just went after whatever you wanted. You know, if you wanted a part, you went after it hook, line, and sinker. You didn't hold back. I think you could do it.
Yeah. I think I could. I mean, I might, and I have an idea of something I discussed with my my editor in New York and my agent. So, yeah, and it's show business oriented. And I would probably be best to stick to something I know pretty well. I'm toying with that idea. And again, I feel like if I'm going to do it, I want to do it well and I want to do it right. So I'll probably take that step. You know, we'll see where it goes.
But I
do have an idea. You know, that's half the battle. Do you have an idea? I think I have a pretty good idea.
Yeah, that's great. I hope you do. I'm looking forward to reading it. You seem to have a very close relationship with your kids. I mean, just talking to you, you mentioned your kids, and you mentioned them in the book, and you seem to have a very... I mean, were you close to your... It doesn't seem like you were very close to your mom. Were you close to your dad?
I'll start with my mom. Really close with my mom, you know, and she was a wildly profane, crazy, wonderful person. My dad, you know, was a very brilliant guy, and thankfully, just being around, I probably learned more just through osmosis, just hearing him. He was at NYU when he was 16 years old. He was a bright guy, but he was troubled, you know, and talk about this in the book. He was a troubled man. He was a genius on some level, you know, academically, but he could never quite put it all together to complete any kind of project that he started. And if anything I've tried to do in my life, I've seen the suffering of my dad. I went, I'm going to finish it. I don't care if it's crap. I'm just going to finish it. And it'll be as good as I can be. I think he was always tortured in his own life. It would never be good enough. It would never somehow meet the expectations of
his parents. Wasn't he proud of you?
He was very proud of us. Yeah, he was. But, you know, again, he was very self-absorbed in his own little world sometimes.
But you're nothing like that. You seem totally different. You're much more approachable. I mean, easy to talk to. You're pleasant. You seem to have a happy life.
Yeah, that's how kids, I think, sometimes can be the opposite of what their parents are. And it's probably by design. And some of it was just sheer will to go, I don't want to be that person. So, yeah, I'm sure I made a conscious effort to not be the type of person he was in some ways. In other ways, I wish I was more like him. I mean, I think he had just amazing ability to be a sounding board, to be my tutor. I mean, the guy knew, could speak Spanish, could speak French, could, you know, he would sit in his room, do calculus just for fun, you know, and that was I'm blown away by that. But, you know, with my own children, yes, we're really close. It's a hard thing to be a friend of your children as well as to be their parent. And you got to know when to be each, you know, because you can't, being hard, you know, you have to sometimes make harsh decisions with your children just in terms of, you know, they're making stupid decisions and you got to step up and correct them.
Now, how old are your kids today?
22 and 19.
Wow.
And I tell you, being unemployed, you know, in my middle years when things slowed down, honestly, I was never completely unemployed. I was always off either doing a play, regional theater, maybe I wasn't doing Oscar-winning films or Mad Men or whatever, but I was constantly working at my craft. But, you know, the downtime, that was the blessing of being at home, was I have a lot of quality time with my kids, because my wife has, throughout the years, has had a very consistent job working in the medical profession. So,
right.
You know, when I wasn't bringing in a big paycheck, she was doing pretty well, and I was Mr. Mom, you know, and that was just a blessing, you know, it really was. And I recognized that even during the time I was going through it, wished I had a better career. But again, you know, I mean, I talk about that in the book, is that I realized that I wanted them to see me, even if I wasn't working on some high profile project, I wanted them to see me working towards something. I didn't want them to see their dad sitting around watching TV
right.
all day long, or just shopping or vacuuming. You know, I mean, I really started to try to write seriously. I tried to, you know, generate my career just through networking with people that I had worked with, and so I felt at the very least, even if I didn't succeed, they would see me try. So that was the blessing of unemployment that I learned, and how to you know, exist with my kids when I really was, you know, acting as Mr. Mom in those days.
Did any big parts ever get away from you? Did you ever almost have a huge part and then it suddenly didn't happen? I know there was.
Oh, yeah.
I think you mentioned one in the book, but I can't remember what it was now.
I recall reading for some really nice stuff. I remember I read, and they were doing a film called The Last Detail.
Oh, yeah.
Now, actually, was doing Jack Nicholson, and I read for the part that eventually went to Randy Quaid. And I went, wow, you know, that would have been a great, great part. It didn't fall my way in that regard. You know, there have been a few pretty nice roles throughout the years that just, you know, that's the nature of the business. You try as hard as you can to be what the director, producer wants, but, you know, sometimes it just doesn't happen.
I like your Steven Spielberg story. The first time you met him, he was real excited to see you. The second time, he seemed really distant. I thought that was kind of interesting.
Well, you know, I'm sure he had gone through a major change, and maybe I hit him on the wrong day, but the very first time we met, he was blown away by the fact that he was meeting one of his childhood TV idols. And that kind of blew me away, because he was right, you know, coming up as the biggest thing in Hollywood. He had just done Jaws, and I met him on a film that he did after Jaws, which actually didn't turn out that well. Something called, 1942 it was called.
1941, I think, yeah.
1941, yes.
Yes,
1941. And it didn't do well at the box office. He, you know, subsequently rebounded and did E.T. and Close Encounters. But I met him on the set when he was doing The Twilight Zone, and he, at that point, was the, you know, the uber power of Hollywood. He was just infallible. And, yeah, he kind of gave me the cold shoulder. I don't know why. I mean, I kind of thought, oh, I'm going to get this fabulous reaction. He's going to hugs and here, look, take me, drag me around, and introduce me to the stars of his movie like he did the first time. And, you know, he kind of looked at me and kind of went, how the hell did that guy get in here?
But yeah.
ouch, that hurt, you know. And I just went, who knows, you know. You just went, I thought it would be this, but it was that. And, you know, maybe I'll meet him one day and I'll say, what was happening that day? And he probably won't even remember that I was there.
You may not. That's true. It's interesting to put that in the book, and you know, we get to see what you went through and all these parts, and how you got them, and how you did, or how you didn't get them, and it's interesting. I mean, the whole thing with Lucy. I'm trying to picture Lucy smoking a cigarette, and I can't in my mind. I've never seen her smoke a cigarette. So
just listen to her voice, and it's, you know, when she got older, you could really hear that.
Oh, you could hear it, but I never saw a cigarette in her mouth. I mean, you never saw her on TV with a cigarette that I can remember.
Yeah. Well, I don't think I ever saw her off the set without a cigarette in her mouth, and I saw her quite a bit when we were working on her studio, which was Desi Lou. We shot My Three Sons there, and she was the studio head. She had parted ways with Desi and was running the place.
So she would actually show up someday without any warning?
She was just, you know, I'd be out on my bike riding around, you know, just taking a cruise, and she'd be racing, you know, from in her golf cart from her offices to some screening room or down to the set or doing something, and She was, she just was Lucy. She just was, cigarette dangling out of her mouth, three or four people hanging on for dear life as she'd speed around the lot in her little golf cart. And that was one of the funniest things to me is that I knew her well from, from I Love Lucy, was one of the greatest sitcoms ever made. And so, the first time she whizzed by me in her golf cart, she goes, "Hi, Barry." I went, "Hey, she just knew my name. That was Lucy. That was weird, And
that must have been a cool thing, yeah.
Great weird, but it was unexpected. And then she eventually hired me to come on to be on her show as I was Gail Gordon's son. I was, Arnold Mooney. He was Mr. Mooney in the bank. And so,
Was he like, Gail Gordon? I can only imagine what he was like. You don't mention him in the book, but
I don't even recall. I don't think I had much to do with him in the couple episodes that I did. The one episode that I recall best was when she gave me a mohawk, and she was, I think the story had her trying to demonstrate her frugal ways to Mr. Mooney, who was the bank president. That was kind of her and I having our little comedic moment. The other one was like a Boy Scout. He wasn't that. He was the Scoutmaster. But I just recall him being kind of, not a particularly kid-friendly kind of guy, But then again, I never really worked with him that much.
I mean, he was so good at being a grouch. I mean, it was perfect to put him in those parts because that's, he's so good at doing it. I mean, and getting so annoyed with Lucy all the time. It was just fun to watch.
Yeah, he was, another guy who sort of had a reputation as a grouch was William Frawley, who played Bob on Princeton. But he loved kids. He went out of his way to just be, just to be the friends of kids and would take the time to talk to you.
The adult he had trouble with.
that's pretty true. I think he was not. Certainly Vivian Vance and he had their issues, but he loved kids.
How did Vivian Vance treat you? I mean, was she nice to you?
She was another one that kind of struck me as not a real kid-friendly person. It's like looking at somebody through a keyhole. I'm spending, a half an hour, 2 days with these people and working an hour here, an hour there, and then, trying to make some analysis of how they interact with people. It's kind of hard. We didn't have a warm and fuzzy little relationship in the moments that we had together. But that's not to say that she might have been a quite a warm, loving person in her home life.
But you hear those stories about her. She was supposed to be fatter than Lucy, and to make Lucy look better. And you wonder, I mean, I've heard that. So I've heard that more than a couple of times. And you wonder if that's really true. And
I'd heard. They were great together as a team, and I think Lucy really loved Vivian as her partner. One of the funny stories that I thought that I recount in the book, and it explains that animosity that Fred Mertz and his wife Ethel had, Bill Frawley and Vivian Vance, is that in the early days of the casting of I Love Lucy, the first great sitcom. Vivian was talking to Desi and Lucy, and they were telling her, we've hired William Frawley to be your husband on the show. And she blurted out, "Oh, that old fart, nobody would believe I'd be married to that old geezer," or something, and Frawley was in the next room and heard her say that.
And that's absolutely true. I remember thinking that watching the show, what are these two doing together? They seem so different.
Yeah, well, that's what it was funny, because everyone went, it's like a marriage. You go, "Oh, these people, they hate each other, but they're sticking it out." And I think a lot of people related to that.
And what do you owe to having such a good head on your shoulders, though? I mean, it seems like your whole life you've had it. You really know what you're doing. You really have it together. I mean, nobody's got it totally together, but you seem to have it pretty well together.
It's going to sound like the biggest cliche in the world, but it's probably true, is that my wife sort of has been the most tolerant, patient, stabilizing factor in my 40, 50 years, when we've been together for 30 years.
What is it about her? What is it about her that you just love so much?
She's got a great sense of humor. She doesn't care one iota about me being famous. She wants me to be happy. She wants me, and I'm happiest when I'm working, so she wants that. But yeah, you know, it's the blessing of somebody who has her own life, her own cares, her own interests. We are together, but we're traveling, you know, our own paths and supporting each other in the best way that we can. And she's
How does she react when somebody comes up? Let's say you're eating dinner together, and somebody comes up and approaches you and says they recognize you. How does she react to that?
She likes it. I mean, it depends how I'm approached too. If it's somebody who's kind of a strange, bizarre creature from another planet, you know, we kind of look at each other. If it's somebody who comes up and is, you know, obviously a fan and loves the show and is, you know, and it depends what situation. If they're coming up and just want to say hi, and could you sign this and thanks for the memories, and they go off. But, you know, if somebody wants to sit down and, you know, have a meal with you, you go, yeah, maybe another time, you know.
Right, yeah, absolutely. You just want to be left alone at that point.
Yeah, she's been great. But, I think I've been fairly resilient and determined. You know, if there's one quality that I feel like I've had some, you know, ups and downs, but I think in the downs I go, I'm going to keep on pushing, and in the ups, try not to kind of fall in love with myself too much to go, wow, you know, I'm so darn special here that I deserve everything that I'm getting. So finding that balance of, you know, being motivated but not being, you know, a big shot kind of, that all kind of comes into play, I think, of keeping your head straight in this business.
You don't seem to have ever had a really horrible moment in your life. I mean, reading the book, I can't think of anything that was, I mean, you had times where you weren't sure where the next part was going to come from, but, I mean, every actor, not every actor, but a lot of actors go through that, but, I mean, have you ever had a moment that was just so bad that
there was a period when I probably was at the most unemployed in my life, hadn't met my wife yet, my mother had passed away recently, I was doing drugs, you know, I was probably filling with a crowd of people that was, you know, peers, actors were all kind of, you know, commiserating with each other. You start partying a little too much. I think it was a moment that I detailed in the book that I went to try to score with a drug dealer, and I tried to, you know, visit him in the wee hours of the morning. And,
yes.
I went into his room, and the guy pulled a gun on me and pulled the trigger. You know, and God knows why, the bullet didn't go off, or, you know, and it was just weird. You know, it didn't hit me until the next day or a week later. I'm going, that was wrong, you know. I mean, that was dumb of me, and how have I let myself get into a situation like that, you know. It just was bad, you know, and I'd say, you know, if I have to pinpoint a moment in time, you'd go, well, that certainly pretty much nailed it. You know, that was not a good moment.
Nothing worse than that.
Proud of myself.
Yeah.
It could have ended tragically. I could have been one of those tragic footnotes of a child actor. And unfortunately, you know, everything that would have preceded that and came after it would have just been nailed down to that one miscalculation in my life of, you know, a youth where you're confused. But, you know, then you're defined by that. And that's kind of yeah, happens to a lot of child actors that, you know, they'll have one major, you know, stumble, but then they're the rest of their life they're defined by that. And, yeah, it's probably not fair.
If you went and did your play in New York, it seemed to, and you came back to L.A., I don't know how long it was after you did the play, but that seemed to be not too great a time for you either.
Well, that's when things, you know, when it finally dawned on me that the, you know, the gravy train had left the station without me. I think I came back thinking, well, I'm going to resume my television and film career, having just, you know, been on Broadway, and I found, for whatever reason,
had people forgotten you?
Climate, you know what had happened, and it happens about every 10 years, is that television sort of reinvents itself, goes through a phase, and what I recall very vividly at that time, my agent saying, is there's just no roles for young people. And if you recall, this was the late 70s, everything was Dallas, Falcon Crest, Knott's Landing,
right.
And it was all older people involved in, you know, in skullduggery and adultery and, you know, whatever. And I just recall him saying, there's just not that many parts out there for a guy, you know, in your mid to early 20s, late 20s. And so then, you know, not too long after that, yeah, became everything got youth skewed. You know, 90210 came out, and right. Buffy, and it kind of, the table flipped, and it became almost like, hey, you're a little too old now to go out on Buffy, or use 90210, you know, and it was weird. I mean, I feel like a couple times in my career that the timing of where I was in my life was not in sync with what the majority of roles that were being cast in television at that time. I think probably around the mid-90s is when things finally got in sync with being able to play teachers, lawyers, professors, you know, that kind of thing became my niche. And, and that kind of led to a rebirth of my career.
Now, you and I actually know somebody in common, and I'm amazed because you mentioned him in the credits of your book, John Gilstrap.
Oh, yeah, John. John, well, when I was first, how did I come to meet John? I was in the throes of, I got the offer to do the book, and I can't even remember who now, but I think it was a doctor that I knew who had some things published, and I was just trying to put some feelers out to go, who's a good agent? I need an agent to negotiate this deal. And somebody put me in touch with John, and we actually hit it off really great. I mean, just on the phone. And
oh, he's a terrific guy.
We've had dinner a couple times, and I just, you know, he was a wealth of information for me. He's a very successful writer, and he's into so many other different things in his life. I'm blown away that he's makes me feel very inferior because he has so many interesting other things that he does besides write. But terrific man, terrific guy, great writer.
You got to work with Gene Reynolds too from MASH. What a talent he was too. Which, I don't know. He's still around, Gene Reynolds?
Well, Gene Reynolds. Actually, I just sent Gene a book yesterday. Yeah, Gene was the guy who brought me onto My Three Sons. I mean, he was in the room. You know, he knew me. It was when the casting session was being held. He was the director of My Three Sons at that time. I had a read for Don Federson, who was the producer, and a couple other people. But Gene was, when I recount the story in the book, was the one friendly, smiling face in that room of somber-looking mugs. And Gene was a child star in his day. He did a couple films with Errol Flynn, Santa Fe Trail. So he knew, Gene, look him up on IMDb. Gene was an actor and a child actor at one point. And so he knew what it was like to stand in my shoes. And he was a great presence in the room, and then subsequently became, you know, a real pal. I mean, I still see him, try to have lunch with him a couple times a year, and you know, he's a great guy.
And so mate, that's one of the wonderful things about being an actor. You meet so many different people. I mean, your experiences. I mean, you've met hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people that, you know, you've worked with and become close to, and you just know a lot of different people. And doesn't that feel good?
Yeah, I guess so. You know, I mean, I guess everybody knows a lot of people usually, in show business. I know a lot of people that other people are familiar with or famous or well-known in some way. So, yeah, that part of it maybe seems like, gee, you've got some leg up that you're hobnobbing with the rich and famous. And the bottom line is they're all people, you know, and with flaws, and some are nicer
right.
than others, and some acted like my best friend, and then, you know, years later I tried to connect with them and they wouldn't return the phone calls. So, you know, it's a strange business, and some people are completely human and are lovely people, and some are not, you know. And
I just wonder, I don't want you to name any names, but I'm just wondering if there was anybody along the way that you came in contact with who you just couldn't stand and didn't get along with. There had to be somebody.
Yeah, sure. There were people that I've worked with that I just went, you know what, that wasn't pleasant. And again, I guess I tend to give people the benefit of the doubt and go, man, maybe they're having a bad day, you know.
Well, that's good.
Whatever.
Yeah.
I just went, I don't know. I don't have to go home and sleep with these people or have dinner with them ever again.
Exactly.
You know, I'm working with them. It would be a real pain in the rear if you got on a television series and it lasted 4 or 5 years and you found like you didn't really like the person that was your co-star. That to me sounds like, you know, an actor's version of hell. that would be very, very difficult to do.
Right, exactly. Now, Paul Jackson, you mentioned Charmed on the back of the book. Were you in Charmed at all?
No, but Paul has become a great friend of mine. He's a great writer, director. I met Paul when I was doing Lois and Clark. He was a writer-producer on Lois and Clark, the newsman, the one with Terry Hatcher.
Right, Terry Hatcher. It must have been fun to meet her.
She was a hottie, you know, and she was at the prime hottie in those days.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
And it was great. I had a recurring character. I played Sheldon Bender, who was a skullduggerous attorney who was representing Lex Luthor. So, you know, what a client, you know, to have the evilest man in Metropolis.
And Dean Cain was...
Go ahead. No. And then Paul has cast me in Sliders. I worked with him in Sliders, Soldiers of Fortune. You know, he's been a great friend of mine over the years.
No, I was going to say, Dean Cain looks like he'd be a nice man to talk to. I mean, he just seems, every time you see him, he just seems very pleasant.
Dean, you'd say? Dean is
Cain.
A great guy. I did a movie with him on Hallmark called Final Approach, and right. Dean and I spent a lot of time together. We were on a plane that was hijacked, and in the end, Dean and I land the plane, and Dean was my co-pilot.
I think that was written by that Good Morning America flying. What's his name? John? I can't remember name, but I've read some of his books.
No kidding. No, I don't remember it. But Dean was, a great seatmate. You know, I mean, we spent a lot of time because you do a film like that, you're sitting in a mock-up of an airplane, and they don't want to put everybody on and everybody. It's like loading and unloading a real airplane every time. So once they get you in the plane, they stick you in your seat like you're on the tarmac for 8 hours. So, right. Yeah, Dean and I, you know, sat next to each other for many an hour, and he was a fun guy, really great guy.
John Nance, that's the guy's name. He writes disaster airplane thrillers, which are really fun to read, actually.
Oh, interesting. Didn't know they came from some source material.
No. Now, what are you going to be working on in the new year? Do you have any idea?
Well, I just finished a film with Ben Affleck.
Right. When will that be out?
I think that will be out probably, they're still filming it. They're actually in Turkey right now.
Wow.
It takes place during the Iranian takeover of the U.S. Embassy in the 1970s. There was a big hostage crisis, and actually that's the centerpiece of the story, and it's about an amazing, amazing story about how they were able to get six Americans out during that crazy, crazy first few weeks of the takeover. You know, there was an amazing story. It's true story. It was just, I think, declassified probably in the late 90s. George Clooney originally bought it, and from a magazine article. And anyway, he's producing it, and Ben Affleck is starring.
Did you get to meet George Clooney?
No, I didn't. No, he wasn't on the set that day.
No,
I worked with Bryan Cranston, who's one of the stars of it.
Oh, the guy from Breaking Bad. This is my favorite show right now. I've been going through the seasons. What a show that is.
Oh, you know, and the week before that, I worked on Castle, and Dean Norris, who plays the DEA agent on that. He was, and I.
Oh, he said, is he that heavyset guy? That's.
Yeah.
I
get the name right. It's not Walt, is it? Walt is. That's.
Oh, he's great. Yeah, he's a great. I've seen him somewhere before. He's one of those actors you know you've seen, but you can't remember where you've seen them.
Oh, that's what I said to him. I said, you know, hey man, you know, I'm blown away. Believe me, I'm sure you've been working for 25 years before this, but you just came onto my radar screen with Breaking Bad, and I'm blown away. You know, I love that show. And then I had the good fortune about a week or two after that of working with Bryan Cranston. So, you know, I said the same. And they were both happy to report. They were both terrific guys.
So what's coming next after what you just mentioned? Anything in the future that you know of?
Well, you know, again, I mean, that's you know, Hostel 3 will be coming out at probably the end of 2011. Argo is 2012. You know, I'm just an actor in the stage of trying to get the next job, and I've been auditioning for a bunch of things, and we'll see where it goes.
Well, I hope you get a job, a nice job that takes you, takes a long time, like a series or something. It'd be nice.
Well, I did make my pitch to Bryan Cranston. I gave him my book, and I said, consider this a bribe to put me on your show. he's one of the producers, so I said maybe I'll show up on Breaking Bad next year. Cause
I think is this the final season for Breaking Bad, the one coming up? It seems to me
I heard that. Yeah, I think they're gonna film two in one. I think they're gonna try to do two seasons in one shooting schedule. And yeah, I don't know where it's gonna go. I'm anxious to see. I love that show.
I love the scene. I watched the scene where they're all sitting around on the couch and they've got the pillow. Whoever has the pillow is the one that can talk. And I love that scene. There's something really special. And you know, as serious as the show is, it's very funny, too.
It is. It's odd because it catches kind of interesting human behavior and nothing really spectacular. You know, you tell a person to watch a show like that, and if they haven't seen the previous four or five episodes, they watch and they go, "What are you talking about? Nothing happened. There was no car chases, no
right.
You know, giant explosions. One or two things, kind of, you know, maybe a couple of dramatic, you know, incidences happened. But for the most part, it's just the you know, detailing a guy who is so far in over his head, you know, in a moral man caught up in a very immoral situation. And that part of it, you know, once you get hooked into that, it's a terrific, terrific show."
And he's real. I mean, it's funny because he's sort of like a loser, but he's not. I mean, he's got that kind of got that double edge to him. He's sort of, you know, I don't know how it plays out in the second, third, fourth season because I'm only up to the second season. But I mean, I know he's very sick, but I don't know what happens after that. But he's sort of.
I love that turn in the show because he does get into the drug trade because he has no money. He's got a son who has CP. He's not
right.
A high school teacher, and you know he has nothing to leave them, and he's just been diagnosed as a terminal patient. So he, you know, says, "I'm going to do this one-time score, you know, leave it for my family, and I'll be dead in 6 months." And I love that as the story unfolded, it turned out that he goes into remission now that he's sort of too deep into the hole.
Right.
That was early on, so yeah, that's how it kind of. You know, the impetus for him becoming who he is now, which is involved in this whole, you know, the cartels and people like that. But he is just a science teacher from high school. Great writing.
He's kind of building in power and in nerve. I mean, he gets to the point where he's not afraid of anybody anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting the way that character builds. It's a great.
Right.
It's just
he's always forced into you know, something because it's his family's threatened. You know, there's always something that pushes him into a direction that he has to do something that he normally would never even consider doing. Yeah, it's a great show.
Where are you doing your book tour? I mean, where are you going besides California? I assume you're doing some in California.
Well, I did, you know, I'm doing some in here in California. I'm going to be doing a couple of book signings here in L.A., Book Soup on November 30th, December 1st. There's a Barnes & Noble in Burbank. I think I'm going to do something at the Santa Monica Library sometime in 2012. And wherever it takes me, you know, I mean, I'm open to talk to anyone and go anywhere. So,
if you could pick one place to travel to, what would it be?
Outside of America,
yes,
I mean,
yes.
Or outside of America, yeah, probably I'd like to go to the London, you know, I don't know, I guess that's pretty boring.
You've never been to London?
I've never been out of, like, to Europe. I mean,
I think you should go, I really do.
My wife and I have talked about maybe next year, depending how well the book does,
right.
We may actually try to do that, because neither one of us have gone out of the you know, the United States anywhere further than Hawaii, really. So yeah, it's kind of sad, but I don't know. I'd love to go to Europe, you know, travel around.
You're just a busy guy, so that's a good thing.
Well, it is good, and you know, but I'm busy trying to get work. You know, that's the work of an actor, is to keep busy trying to get that next job, and that's been my life, and I've been.
Oh, one more thing I wanted to ask you, Don Grady, was his sister on Eight Is Enough?
Yes, Lanny O'Grady.
Okay,
yeah.
I thought they were. I wasn't sure. I wanted to ask that, but I thought I'd heard that at some point. She was so great on that show, too.
Yeah, and she had met with a kind of an unfortunate, you know, she really had a hard time, too, you know, transitioning from being famous on Eight Is Enough into a life that's not in the focus, you know.
Yeah,
very
it is
tough,
sad.
Tough thing for people, yeah. yeah.
Right. Well, it's been great to talk to you, Barry. We've been talking to Barry Livingston for the whole hour about his book, The Importance of Being Ernie, From My Three Sons to Mad Men, A Hollywood Survival Tells All, from Citadel Press, and it's in all your bookstores now. Thank you so much. It's been great.
Appreciate it. Yeah,
I've enjoyed it.
I really appreciate it. Yeah, it's been fun. Thank you so much.
And this has been David's Book Talk, and we'll talk to you next time.